Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and we are going to talk about electric cars this hour of the program. Our guest has been with us before. I can't believe it was in 2007 when Who Killed the Electric Car was released. Chris Payne is the co-writer and director of the now just released Revenge of the Electric Car. He has appeared on all kinds of national television, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, Nightline, ABC World News, Democracy Now!, Science Friday on NPR, and he speaks nationally. He has film projects, including executive producer Mark Neal's Charge, Faster, and No Maps for These Territories. He was raised in the San Francisco Bay Area, and in wake of the BP disaster in 2010, he co-founded the site Counterspill.com. He supports the work of Rainforest Action Network, Impro Theater, the Black Rock Arts Foundation, and everyone who is helping to reduce the use of gasoline. This is an interesting film because the idea of the film is that the time has come. This is the time for the electric car. And so the guy who was really vilified, GM, in the earlier film, now took up and championed the electric car. Bob Lutz, vice chair of GM in 2003, was completely dismissive of the electric car and then became a champion of the Chevy Volt. It looks at Tesla as well. It looks at Nissan and what they're doing in this area. And it looks at a gentleman who is just doing this on his own, just taking old cars and putting electricity in those cars. We'll be welcoming phone calls. We get flooded with calls on this issue, so I tell you early on, and I'm particularly interested in hearing from anybody who has an electric car, particularly one of the Chevy Volts, and I know they've had problems. There was a news story on this the last couple of weeks. We'll talk about that. Or a Nissan Leaf. If any of you, by chance, have been driving one of those, we'd like to hear from you because part of our conversation will center on those cars. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hi, Chris.
Hey, great to be on the show.
Yeah, very nice to have you on. I can't believe that other film was 2007.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And it's amazing what's happened in this whole industry in the past 5 years, isn't it?
Yeah, times change quickly. I mean, some things never change, but at least industry is finally, like, you know, taking this issue seriously.
They certainly are. So is this indeed, have we reached a point where the time has come, these cars are going to be the cars of the not very distant future?
Yeah, I think when we say the time has come, it's mostly about you know, our relationship to oil. And what will push that faster than anything are high oil prices. So when you hit, you know, we don't know if this is tomorrow or in a year and a half, but when you hit $5 gasoline and $6 gasoline, suddenly everybody, regardless of their politics or their environmentalism or anything, will be saying, good grief, how can I start plugging my car in, which, you know, at $1 a gallon. So in the long run, oil is probably running out. I mean, I don't even know why I say probably. It's definitely running out, and the impact of it is really tough on us. So if we can get renewable power into our cars, that's part of the solution.
Mm-hmm. I think it was Lutz who was saying toward the end of the film, when GM declared bankruptcy, that they were getting criticized for making all these big trucks and the kinds of cars that nobody wanted. And his comment was interesting. They made the big trucks. They did what he said, the American public goes where gas prices are. And I think that's been true for years.
Yeah, it is true. It always will be. And you'll see that the lower prices of gasoline are, the more people are critical of electric cars. It's kind of a strange thing, but I think, you know, in the long run, this will be good for us. And even with the issues of coal and things that are right to worry about, the electric car really offers a pathway out, at least in terms of having an automobile.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start with GM, because you start the film with Danny DeVito, of all people, who used to have an EV1 and later test drives a Chevy Volt. This first film that you did wasn't very flattering when it came to GM or to Bob Lutz. And what a turnaround this guy has had.
Yeah, well, you could also argue that Bob Lutz is just one heck of a salesman. He's I think when GM was going down and facing bankruptcy, and very few people were excited about anything they were making because they had been making mediocre cars for so long. I think he saw getting back into a plug-in vehicle as a way to reinvent General Motors. So there's a lot of strategic thinking on what he's doing. But on a deeper level, I think he really finally got it. And he went, wow, this is the future of cars, not just for any environmental reason, but because you can do so much with electric drivetrains. And suddenly you have the fastest car off the line, and suddenly you have a whole new way of designing cars that doesn't require a giant engine up front. You could put the batteries underneath the car, your passenger compartment changes. And so from a car designer perspective, you're very excited.
Yeah, and he gave you access. How did this whole thing work behind the scenes, to go behind the scenes, meetings and the whole nine yards?
Well, you can imagine that GM wasn't very excited about us coming back and filming there.
Oh, really?
I don't know why. You know, I thought we had done a fairly honest portrayal of the first story, but they're pretty skeptical about that. And the film really started with Tesla, because I had known Tesla out here in California. Elon Musk, at the very end of the first film, we gave Tesla maybe 5 seconds in the movie. And I went to Elon and said, hey, if you guys are really doing this, why don't you let us behind the scenes? I will not share any footage with anybody until 2011. He said, sure, come on back. So once we had Tesla on board and we started filming them in 2008, we began to pursue other car companies. And, Bob, I have to give him credit for saying, okay, let these guys in. It took some while and some back and forth with him to get permission, but we did that, and we got into Nissan and several other car companies.
Mm-hmm. And if it had not been for a place like Tesla, would GM even be considering electric cars? Did you have to have a real visionary at first?
Well, that's what Bob says, and I think he's probably pretty right about that. Of course, GM considered electric cars in the 1990s. That's where the EV1 came from that got this all started. Tesla, in Bob's words, gave him the ammunition in the boardroom to say, listen, these guys out in Silicon Valley are making electric cars. We can do a better job than that. Let's get back in the game.
And Tesla went through, it was amazing, the ups and downs that company went through, which you highlight in the documentary.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, they practically went bankrupt, too, in the first part of the recession, 2008, when things fell out. All their investment money drove up. And you'll see even this last couple weeks Aptera announced bankruptcy. It takes an amazing amount of cash to start a major car company. There's just so much you have to do in terms of testing and performance. And I think Elon bit off more than he expected.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting from a filmmaking and storytelling point of view to be there for that.
Yeah. Do you have one of his cars? I know you're in the film just quite by chance, actually, that your car needed to be fixed.
I know. I didn't want to be in the film. And my producer's standing with me, and I had ordered, after we finished Who Killed the Electric Car, Dean, who paid for the first film, said, Chris, we've got to buy one of these Teslas. And I go, I've never bought a car that costs more than $20,000. And he goes, yeah, but I'm putting $1 million into your film, so you better step up. Like, we got to, tell the car companies that if we want these cars, that if we can afford them, we're going to buy them. So, anyway, I was on the waiting list for 2 years there, and we're standing there filming with Elon, and I go, I think that's my car they're working on right here. And Elon's going on and on about some story about how the car... He says, you've got to tell him that's your car. And so I said, okay. So that's where that came from. And I've gotten that car now. I've had it for almost 3 years, if you can believe it. It's been a terrific performer. They did a great job on that car.
It's pretty snazzy looking, isn't it?
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful car. I don't drive it that much because I'm afraid I'm going to wreck it.
Oh, no. Isn't that the thing with a car like that? You're going to get some darn scratches on it, and you can't, and so you drive that way.
I know, and that's why I like to buy used cars, usually, because then you don't care if the yo-yo next to you opens their door into it or something.
Yeah. You had this figure cited in the movie, which I had no idea this was the case. In 1920, there were 300 car makers in this country. What happened?
Yeah, well, in those days, it didn't cost quite as much money to get a car company going. And so the world was really open. They were doing steam cars and electric cars and gasoline cars. Everybody was trying their own car, bicycle cars. And if you had just a little bit of money, you could get a car company going. And what happened was, well, really, the Depression happened. That took all the money out of the game. And then people became very discriminatory, took a lot more time in thinking about what kind of car they would want to buy. And Ford got mass production going, and all the little guys got pushed out of the way.
Mm-hmm. The Volt, let's talk about the Volt a little bit. It has been making news, as you well know, in the last week or so when there was a report of fires, and one of these came from Burlington, Wisconsin, possible fire risk involving damaged Volt batteries. Is this a serious problem for the Volt? You got to make sure these kinds of things don't happen if you're going to go get people go from gasoline to electric.
Yeah, you're right. It's a tough little PR thing for them, and they've got to fix that battery case. So the fire was caused by they went through all these NTSA tests, and they left the battery pack fully charged in there. And I think the first time they did the test, the car was sitting there for 3 weeks, and they turned it on its side and upside down, and it part of the battery caught fire. And they were able to repeat the test to go, this could be a problem and a serious fire. The media went completely wild for this. And meanwhile, if you look at what the NTSA has been doing in the last year, there have been hundreds of thousands of cars either under investigation as individual cars within brands or flat recalled for fuel leak issues. So I like to say on this, and I'm not, we'll defend the electric car no matter what, because I do, want to make sure that, the safety issues aren't
sure.
There. But gasoline is far more dangerous. And if they tried to roll out gasoline in 2011 with, 8 gallons of explosive fuel under your children everywhere you go, it would never get through any tests. So I think this is part of the growing pains for the media and for the technology, and I wouldn't worry about it.
Mm-hmm. Do you like the Volt?
I think it's a good car. I was pretty skeptical because I was kind of purist. I don't like the fact that there's a gasoline engine in there, but I understand that for most people, you don't want to have to worry about whether your car is going to run out of power after 40 or 100 miles. And this is a great transmission technology. And the thing with that car is, you'll drive for 40 miles and the gasoline won't turn on. So most days you'll never hear that engine turn on. And then when you need it, it's there.
Mm-hmm. The other amazing story, because this guy really went out on a limb to build the first pure electric car, the Nissan, Carlos Ghosn, is that his name? Ghosn?
Yeah, Carlos Ghosn.
He really went all out here.
Yeah. Yeah, $6 billion he put into developing a plug-in car, and the first one they have is the Nissan Leaf. That's a big investment, and Carlos is not the kind of guy that does things for environmental reasons. At one point, he says in the film, "I'm not doing this, I'm not doing this for any particular political reason. It's because the public is expecting this from us." But I think underneath that is he's making a big strategic move to get around Toyota, who's monopolized the high-end hybrid market. And he realizes that if he's first to market with a terrific pure electric car, the public's going to pay attention to that,
mm-hmm.
and not just in the U.S., but all around the world. So very unexpected to get access to that story, and we had to jump through some barriers to do that.
And then, as you say, at the end of the film, it is, what, the Leaf, the 2011 car, the European car of the year?
I think it became the 2011 world. When we finished the film, it was the European car. Then it became the world car of the year. The car has gotten some excellent notices. My girlfriend's driving it. She loves that car. In California, that car, you can get it for about $25,000, which is still a lot of money, but not nearly as much as, what we were talking about for Teslas 2 years ago.
Right. And when is the price going to come down so that it is comparable? $25,000 is okay, but people would like to see $17,000, $18,000 so that most people can afford this.
Yeah, and what's going to take it is people who can afford to buying cars at this price level, because gas cars have had the advantage of 100 years of amortization, and they're making hundreds of thousands of cars. Electric cars are being made in batches of 5 and 10,000 right now, so it's a lot more expensive. As more people buy these cars, and this is the same thing that happened with gas cars, then the car makers can make more of them and the price will drop.
I see. We are going to go to phone calls and we'll take them momentarily. We're talking with the co-writer and director of Revenge of the Electric Car, Chris Payne. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our lines are filled, so wait a minute before you call or you'll be nothing but frustrated. We'll be with you in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To phone calls now for Chris, starting with Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hi there, Chris. Good to be able to talk to you. I'm a big fan of these vehicles as well. First of all, Kathleen, a quick note for you. Unless, Chris, you got better information on this or more recent than I do, what I heard at the Green Drive Expo in Madison last summer was that the Leaf is not even being rolled out in our part of the country, because the temperature, you know, it doesn't do that well in the cold, falls, everything like that.
Mm.
And the other quick item, and I believe me, sooner or later today I will get to my question. But the other quick note, what I want to ask about is the Prius, and my understanding is that the advertisement that I saw showed 2012 is a big year for expansion of the Prius models. One of these is going to be called the Prius C, the letter C, uninspired name. But what they're saying about that is that it's going to be smallish, about the size of the Yaris, which is, you know, their very small combustion engine car. And that thing is going to get better mileage than any of the Priuses so far, they're predicting. And it might actually crack the $20,000 price barrier or be very much in the vicinity.
Huh.
Now, the question I have is that I got intrigued by seeing this commercial, so I stopped by a dealership and talked to him, particularly about the plug-in, the Prius plug-in. And what this guy said to me was that, I guess they have these vehicles now where you can actually push an EV button on the console, and what that does is that lets you run in electric vehicle mode until you the internal combustion engine actually has to come in to help out. So what the salesperson told me was that theoretically you could get one of these the plug-in Toyotas, Priuses, and you could drive this thing in electric vehicle mode, and if you were, like, let's say, you know, keeping your speed under about 30 miles an hour, like, you know, not commuting on the interstate, but commuting around town, that there's a real good possibility that you could go.
Your phone's going a little low here, Scott.
Okay.
If you could, okay.
Yeah, you could possibly go for a huge amount of miles without the engine ever coming on. And so my question for you, Chris, is what kind of a challenge does this propose to the EPA to try and gauge what the mileage on a vehicle like this is going to be for the average driver when you've got everybody from somebody who's maybe never using the engine to somebody who's out on the interstate using it all the time?
Well, I don't know. I can't comment on the EPA's struggles to figure out how to classify electric cars. They came out with some mileage ratings of, like, you know, a Tesla gets 250 miles per charge or something. It's very difficult for the world to, like, switch from gasoline metaphors to electric metaphors. A case in point is how hard it was to get from horses to gas. Everything's horsepower, but what's that have to do with a car? Horsepower, and the horseless carriages to begin with. So it's complicated for them to, like, convert everything quickly. You know, the main thing I'm taking away from your question is how great it is that Toyota is finally offering a plug-in car. It was a lot of pressure from environmental and electric car enthusiasts. How come you guys aren't putting a plug on that car? And so they're putting one on next year. I think the pure electric range for that car in, you know, a place with more temperate climate is something like 15 miles, which isn't a lot, but for, again, that day when you're just doing a couple errands, that's plenty to stay in all electric. And then it goes back to being a 50-mile-per-gallon car. So, well, I think we can look forward to that. Keep the pressure up on the Toyota dealers to get that car to Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. And what's the story with the leaf in the Midwest? They're not here yet because of the cold?
Yeah. I think you'll see the Volt before you'll see the leaf. The Nissan, apparently, I've read the press reports, they're doing a cold weather package to give more range in cold climates. It's said that battery packs can be reduced, at least modern ones, by as much as 50% in a cold, super cold weather environment. So if you have a Nissan Leaf with a 100-mile range in a cold weather, it could go down to as low as 50. And that's, you know, it's like, why bother on some level?
Mm-hmm.
This is, I think, the big reason that GM decided to do their a plug-in hybrid. And some of the other car makers, I think Audi is working one and some other ones, because they go, okay, well, it doesn't matter because when we have cold weather day, you have that gasoline to kick in when you need it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Scott, so much for your call. Somebody who couldn't stay online, if two-thirds of electricity is still coming from coal, how is this better?
Oh, it's better in a lot of ways. You know, one thing we couldn't get in the film, and this is the challenge of making a film that you're trying to keep to 90 minutes so the audience can, you know, get home to their babysitters and stuff, is this idea about how much electricity is used by the oil industry to make gasoline. And we all know that, you know, oil comes from the Middle East usually, and it comes over in big ships and gets sent to us. But what a lot of people don't know, including me, a couple years ago, was that once that crude oil gets to the United States, we have to use a ton of electricity. I mean, millions of kilowatt hours to convert crude oil into gasoline. Something like 4 to 6 kilowatt hours per gallon of gasoline. Now, if you took that electricity, wherever it comes from, coal or renewable sources, and you put that directly into a car instead of this middleman process, you could go 20, 25 miles on that. So why do we have this in-between step of oil? And the secondary issue is about where the electricity is going to come from, since we're using it already anyway. Is in the U.S., I think we're 50% coal. That gives electricity a 50% baseline, electric car 50% baseline of being 50% cleaner. The good thing about electricity is the grid can be cleaned up, and you can never really clean up oil.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Bill in Sun Prairie, who I think is a Volt owner. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Kathleen. Yes, I've had my Chevy Volt for just about a year now. I got mine right when they first came out. And I wanted to first address your first caller regarding the Prius C. That does look like a really neat car and great miles per gallon. I will mention, though, he thought it was amazing that if you kept it under 30 miles an hour and you drove under 15 miles each day, you could go for months without buying any gas or using any gas. And that's really the whole appeal of the Chevy Volt, except you don't have to keep it under 30 miles per hour, and you can go more like 35 or 40 miles each day with the Volt and not use any gas. But the real reason I called was just to address the fire issue with the Chevy Volt that's been getting a lot of press lately.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to say that if anybody takes any time to actually read the details around the issue, you'll realize that it's a lot of smoke and very little fire. When you look at the way the media handles this, there's headlines that scare people. But when
you read
the actual issue, there's really nothing there. It's just a case of testing on cars where they did a crash test, and then they did not discharge the energy from the battery. They let the car sit there for 2 weeks, and then a fire broke out. So I always tell folks who ask me, as long as I don't sit in my car after I totaled it, if I don't sit in it for 2 weeks and make sure nobody discharges the batteries, if I don't do that, I don't think I have any risk with this car. And so it's been blown out of proportion, and it will blow over quickly. It's a real non-issue.
That's interesting. So tell me about the Volt. Was it a big thing for you to buy this?
Yeah, it was, because back in December last year, the car was not available here, so I had to go out to Washington, D.C. to buy it and then drive it home. And then, of course, it has a gas engine, so driving it home was no problem. You know, I drove 300 miles and then fill up with gas and keep going. So driving it back long distances is a real flexible car that way. But then once I got here, I barely use any gas for all my trips around town.
And it's really fast, isn't it? I mean, surprisingly fast.
Yeah, exactly.
Hmm.
The good thing about these, when it's all in electric mode, which is the first 40 miles, you hammer the car down, and you feel like you're in a really fast sports car. anyway, for those of us that like speed, it's a pretty fun car.
That wouldn't be me. But I like fun cars, but the speed, I don't know.
Yes, this is dangerous.
Right, right. Thanks, Bill, very much for your call. Great to hear from you.
Thanks, Kathleen.
How many volts are out there, Chris?
I think that, you know, I haven't read the number, honestly, in the last month or two. I think they're up to about 7,000. And they're making them all in one plant in Hamtramck in Michigan. It's a Hamtramck plant in Detroit, which is a great thing. The production line there is so fired up about making these cars. They feel like they're working at a new company, and it's pretty exciting. The time I visited the factory, like every seventh car was a Volt, which is kind of hilarious because you'd see like these giant gas guzzlers one after another, and then there'd be a Volt. And Bob mentioned at one point that they really hope that plant goes all Volt as the car goes internationally. But they've got to get through these press hurdles and train older dealers to know how to fix them when there's problems.
Sure.
Things like that.
Sure. It was interesting to see one of the workers who was building the car, and while he was working on it, thinking about when his children grow up and how proud he can be to say, I worked on this when everything was changing.
Yeah, I know. Well, I think that's a feeling that you get when you drive these cars, too. You know, I know I probably sound like a huge evangelist for this, but it does feel pretty cool to feel like you're, like, part of the new thing, and it's probably a positive.
Right. Let's go back, because I have a hard time understanding this Tesla thing. These are really expensive cars. He almost went broke. Then the stock goes up, and he's living the high life all of a sudden. Who's buying these kinds of cars? What's the story with the rise of this company again? How did they get so much money?
Well, you know, Elon made his money buying and selling companies, actually starting them and selling them. And the one that he's most famous for is PayPal, which he sold to eBay. And when eBay went, you know, through the rock with the stock price, he made a lot of money. And he put almost all of that money into two new companies, actually three, one a solar company and then a space development company and then Tesla. So this is a guy, he's still in his 30s, that just goes all the way in on the projects that he gets involved with. And I think the Tesla ended up costing him a lot more money than he ever expected. That sports car in the film is no longer sold. They made about, I think, 2,000 to 3,000 of those cars. They were $120,000 vehicles. They put all of their attention on this Model S, which is a car coming out at the end of next year, which is a $50,000 car, mm-hmm. much more affordable, still very expensive for most people. But for a lot of Lexus drivers and, you know, people that can afford pricier cars, this is something to look at. And they went public and had a second offering and raised enough money for the company to be a viable entity for quite a few years, which is what people want to know before they go ahead and spend a lot of money for a car.
Right. Thanks, Bill, so much. Nice to hear from you. Let's go to Alex in Toma. Hi, Alex.
Hi, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
Well, I had a question regarding the Chevy Volt. I was wondering, when it switches to gasoline engine, does it begin recharging the battery so that it becomes more of a perpetual type energy source? And if not, is there any research into doing that? Because it seems like it would just be a really great thing that if it just kept recharging that battery, limiting the amount of gas you would have to use.
Yeah, well, what happens is you're absolutely right. The car gets to about 35 miles of pure electric range, no matter how you're driving it, fast or slow or whatever conditions, and then the engine turns on and starts charging the battery pack again. So you're never driving the engine. Almost, I think 99% of the time, you're never driving the wheels with the engine. All the engine is doing is recharging the pack. The advantage with this car, and really with the Prius and any electric car, is that you have regeneration systems, so that when you put on the brakes, instead of burning brake pads, or when you're downshifting and stuff, all the extra energy goes back into the battery pack, which is, you know, maybe the core reason why electricity can be so efficient in an electric car like this. I don't think you'll ever get the physics of a perpetual motion machine out of an electric car, but you get a lot closer than you can when you're trying to deal with the fuel that you're burning in a carburetor.
Hmm. Here's an email from John. Are you aware, Chris, of a company that works with ultra capacitors called EE Store. The talk on the internet a year ago was that they'd been working on something that would revolutionize the electric vehicle industry. I haven't heard anything about them recently.
You know, that's funny you bring that company up. We started charting a whole bunch of stories when we started making Revenge of the Electric Car in 2007, 2008, and that was going to be one of them. You're like, okay, this is going to bypass the chemical battery. You'll have a capacitor on board. This company down in Texas, Store, is going to make this. But they never came to market, and I think it's like a lot of things that there's a lot of hope and promise in the research lab, but this is difficult to get to market. And in the meantime, lithium batteries have become such a, you know, powerful force thanks to laptop computers and our cell phones and now electric cars that this technology seems to be the dominant one for some time.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to David in Barron. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi. Well,
hi.
You already touched on my question about the fires, but here recently, the Bolt owners were notified to shut down their charging stations because they were starting house fires.
I've never heard anything like that. So, yeah, you should send that to the station. I doubt it. Again, watch out for these stories about electric cars. I can't comment on that because I haven't heard anything like that. But there's a lot of internet stuff that gets going. I'll just have to speak a little bit out of turn here and say that there's a lot of resistance to change. People don't like to have to do things in a different way, and if people can wait till the last possible moment to try something new, a lot of people do it. And it makes sense for the long history of human evolution for us to wait as long as possible. But I think that the electric car technology is really much more stable than people might have you believe. And if no one who can afford to steps up right now, we're going to have to wait till a huge gasoline crisis before these things will take off.
Yeah, I have the latest news things here from they're both from the Christian Science Monitor. Rhonda pulled them before the show, and I don't see anything about what he just talked about. The problems were what you described, Chris, and not plugging them in your house, you know, in your garage or whatever. So I think you're right. You do have to sift through
things. The thing with chargers is you can either plug these cars directly into an outlet in your house, or if you want to charge it more quickly, you have, like, you take your washing machine circuit and you put a 220 charger in there, and then your charging speeds up a lot. So it's not like we're putting a big hydrogen station in our house or we're building a new gas fueling station. This is an infrastructure that in many ways is already here.
Uh-huh. Another email. Have you heard of, I don't know how to pronounce this, the Toyota RAV, is it? RAV that will solar power on top of a car?
Yeah, well, Toyota RAV4 EV was one of the electric cars that was in California's program in the 1990s. In fact, I drove one for about 6 years. It was just a terrific car. The roof of any car, including the RAV4, is not big enough to charge off of the sun, even if you lived in, you know, the Sahara Desert. You need a bigger surface area. So what's best for solar charging is you want to use the roof of a house or an apartment building, and then you sell to the grid during the day when it's sunny or when the sun's up, and then at nighttime you buy the power back at a less rate. And Tesla, of all people, has a deal with Toyota now that they're bringing the RAV4 EV back to market, and that should be happening sometime next year as well.
Oh, that's fascinating. So you like this. How long did you drive it?
6 years.
6 years.
Yeah, it was a terrific car. They just took one of the old RAV4 gas cars and they retrofitted to electric, and that car went 100 miles and I recently sold it to a friend of mine that lives up in Spokane or up in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and they're thrilled with it up there.
Ooh, I wish you had sold it to me.
I should have called.
It would have been a long way to get it. Yeah. Thanks, David, very much for the call. Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hi. And the lease is a non-starter for me because I have to have a car that can do hundreds of miles in a stretch at time. And I'm totally sold on the idea of the Chevy Volt. But I see it as a vanity purchase for people who really can afford the gasoline, because I can't pay $40,000 for a Chevy Volt.
Yeah.
And I don't see it getting cheap enough or affordable for it to be a mass market product.
Yeah, I see your point. He's talking about something that a lot of people think.
Yeah. Well, the only way it could become a mass product is that that they've got to get some sales of their first product. And if you look at a lot of technologies, they start with a higher price point, and it's good that they start off with super high quality cars, because that over time you're getting the quality. You're not trying to get a golf cart to be better over time. You're starting with a very high quality product, and you're trying to get the price down. I would not be surprised, especially as oil prices move up in the next 10 years, is that plug-in options become standard on all cars as an option, and it becomes kind of like having automatic brakes or ABS brakes or airbags or something. It's just that we're so early in it, it looks like it's new and incredibly expensive forever.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about Toyota, because Toyota is mentioned in the film. This is the company that's had the market on fuel-efficient cars, on small cars for some time now. They've got to be looking around at Nissan and also at GM and thinking, ooh, we better make sure that we're in this game as well.
Yeah, and not just Toyota, everybody. I mean, Volkswagen and BMW and, you know, Hyundai and Mitsubishi. Nobody wants to get left out.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of push. But Toyota, of course, gets a huge amount of credit for sticking with the Prius when everybody else abandoned ship on hybrids back in the 90s. And they are like, hey, wait, hold on. We can get this Prius to plug in, and we're going to add it to it. One of the things that's been kind of smart for them, I think, is that they said, well, maybe people don't need 40 miles of range on pure electric. They're okay with just 10 miles. And if we can give them 10 miles of pure range with a battery, then we can keep the price down. So this may be a strategic advantage for them that they really get to exploit as it rolls out.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Bill, very much for your call. We need to pause for a moment, and we'll return. We're talking about electric cars. 4 years ago, we were talking about electric cars and how they were killed in this country with Chris Payne, who at that time had released Who Killed the Electric Car? And now we're talking about the just-released Revenge of the Electric Car, which has just been released. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Tony in Columbus. Hi, Tony.
Morning.
Morning.
I call on car dealers in my work, and I've asked the Chevrolet dealers when I see the Volt on the lot, you know, how are sales and what's happening, and they've told me they're not selling the car right now. They're wanting to have the customers come in and do test drives so that more people are familiar with it, as opposed to simply selling it to the first person that wants one, and then apparently there's not a high volume of them, so... I don't know if that's a directive from GM or just a suggestion that they focus on getting lots of people to test drive it rather than selling it.
What an interesting story that is. It makes sense on one level because they're just ramping up on production, and one of their issues is they have to train all these mechanics to how to work on the gas engine and the electric motor, and they don't want to have the cars out there that need service and then they don't have a mechanic available. So I think they realize that education is a huge part of this. I don't think they're doing what they did on the EV1, which is to put the cars out and, you know, not have no intention for them to stay in the market. I think they're just being cautious. But it is interesting that the dealer actually told you that.
Mm-hmm. So
dealer also told me the one thing that is happening, though, is that people are driving it, liking it, but because of the price, they're opting for the Cruise, which has a pretty good mileage car and is measurably cheaper.
That does sound like a car company to me.
Did you try one of these Volts, Tony? Did you drive it?
No, I haven't. I'm of course they're trying to sell them something. I think they figure they don't need to bother with me.
Oh, I'd give it a whirl. What the heck?
Yeah, I should use that as a leverage. I can drive the car. Maybe we can work something out with my hand too.
Right.
I think it's a great time. If people can go and test drive these cars, and then everyone can have personal experience in saying, I didn't like it or I thought it was great, and it doesn't just become, you know, guys like me on the radio. It becomes a lot of people with ground experience. It's kind of an interesting time right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sure is. Thanks, Tony, for the call. Katie in Minneapolis. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, Katie.
I I'm a driver who, I'm in sales, and I drive about 50,000 miles a year, and most of my driving is on interstates and freeways going, you know, 60, 70 miles per hour. And just listening to this, I'm wondering, is there going to be any solutions for those of us who can't just drive 30 miles per hour every day but still want to have a not a gas guzzler as we're driving?
Yeah, well, just to be clear, because I might have misheard you, but the 30 to 40 mile range that of pure electric that the Volt has, for example, does allow you to go, you know, 110 miles an hour if you wanted to. The 30 mile only electric range, I think, had to do with it, where the 30 mile per hour range was on, the plug-in Prius or something. So as you investigate these things, they become clear. But to answer your question, I know Tesla's Model S, their battery pack is, their top one in their new car is 300 miles. And they're dealing with high-speed charging stations on Interstate 5 out here on the West Coast. I doubt they're probably doing lots of these yet because it's so early, but where you could charge your car to go 300 miles in an hour or something like this. So they understand that for the electric car, the pure electric car, to compete in the marketplace, they've got to have longer and longer batteries over time. But I think that the plug-in hybrid strategy is going to prove very effective too. It all comes down to what people are willing to pay and how they can, you know, fit into their lives.
Mm-hmm. How's Detroit? Some of the really remarkable footage. Where in the world was that religious ceremony that really wasn't a religious ceremony? That was an incredible piece of footage with the cars on the stage.
Yeah, wasn't that amazing?
Yes.
We found that piece. I guess I had read about it in the paper that a pastor in Detroit who served almost all factory workers out of Detroit was having a service about when the companies were all going bankrupt and brought three SUVs up on stage. He had them parked beyond the altar place and did a thing about, you know, about our livelihood and our jobs and that we all have to have solidarity and, you know, our jobs are going to be there. And it was a remarkable visual for a filmmaker. We went, wow, this is going in the film because
yes,
picture tells 1,000 words.
It sure does. And too bad that what we were worshiping was the SUV, right?
Yeah, I know. That's like one of those bitter ironies sometimes,
right,
you have to deal with. But
yeah. So is GM really counting on its long-term health to make sure that the American public buys things like the Volt? Is that the future of American car companies, Chris?
Well, I think the future is building better cars. And, you know, I never really expected to become a car guy. These two films have sort of had me spend a lot of time with car companies.
Mm-hmm.
Never expected. And I think most of the people you talk to in Detroit realize that they were making too much mediocrity for too long, and that's why everybody started buying overseas. And even the cruise that your other car was talking about, these cars are all like sort of a much higher level than you're getting from these car companies 5 years ago. The bankruptcy changed a lot of things in Detroit, and I think you'll see better cars coming out of the United States than you used to.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Katie, for your call. Ray in Fond du Lac. Hi.
Hey, I was just wondering as to whether you guys could talk about as why there isn't much of a push for hydrogen-based vehicles. Is it due to infrastructure being in place, or other factors? And I'll take my answer out on.
All right, Ray.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, great question. Well, of course, hydrogen was one of the stories we featured in Who Killed the Electric Car. And, you know, the problem with hydrogen is exactly what you said. Infrastructure is very difficult. Getting hydrogen stations in are super expensive compared to putting in an electric circuit somewhere. And the other problem with hydrogen is that it takes a lot of energy to make hydrogen. Hydrogen is an abundant element in the universe, but to use it here on Earth, you have to extract it from water, and that takes a ton of power, usually fossil fuels. So that pushed hydrogen back a lot. I think for the time being, it's battery electrics.
Email question, what about batteries? Are they recycled after they're used up?
Well, the most toxic battery in the world in mass production is the lead-acid battery, the one we use in our cars. The nickel metal batteries and lithium batteries are substantially cleaner in terms of elements. And the big difference on them is that they're so valuable that they get snapped up for second use, like as power backup stations and stuff like this. So I don't think you'll ever have a problem with battery waste. Even lead acid batteries are something like 95% recycled. You take them to Sears and something like that.
Huh.
And what you find in landfills is people throwing out flashlight batteries. That's more the problem than the car batteries.
Mm-hmm. Bill is next in Sun Prairie. Hi, Bill.
Yes, I was visiting one of my relatives in Michigan some years ago, and one of the people there that was visiting, the same family of my relatives, he was one of the top men in General Motors when EV1 came out. And he trusted me. He said, don't go telling this to other people, but now I can. He said the mega wealthy in America will never allow many electric cars because their need to control, he didn't use the term, but I'm using it, we use it now, the 99 percenters. His boss was a 1 percenter. And you need to have people control. If people have gasoline cars and then they shut down the gasoline to the gasoline station, you have people control. People will not be able to go anywhere with their gasoline cars.
Yeah. Chris.
Well, a lot of people feel like that. And we saw what happened in the 90s in California. The oil industry got involved and helped shut down the electric car programs here with the chargers and so forth. I think the flip side of this, and this is why this new movie is a lot more optimistic in terms of tone, is you look back at Sinclair Lewis when he wrote about the train monopolies of the middle 1800s, and people thought those train companies would never go away. They were the biggest thing. They were the biggest exploiters, the biggest disaster, and none of them really made it into the 20th century with very much power. They all got replaced by new technology and people embracing new ideas. So I hope that the plug-in cars and electric cars are part of that experience of a renewal through innovative technology that you know, in many cases is much better.
Mark in Stevens Point. Hi.
Good morning. I'm curious why the hybrid automobile has developed the way it has with, you know, with a reliance on large batteries and kind of a backup engine in it. When, I mean, trains have been running on diesel hybrids for a long, long time, and I don't think they rely a whole lot on battery. I mean, they start the diesel up and it runs a generator that produces power. Why is it that automobiles have not done the same thing? It seems to me you could get by with a very small diesel engine running, you know, a generator that would drive that car for long distances at very low prices. Can you explain why that hasn't happened?
Well, I'm sure there's a lot of engineers listening to the show that can probably do a better job of that than me. I remember being quite surprised in going to a railroad museum and seeing how early the hybrid freight trains technology was developed. This is, you know, has been around for a long time. A lot of hybrid freight trains run on electric lines. They have, you know, they have, on shorter runs, they use electricity that they pick up along the way. But you are very right. There's super efficient diesel engines that drive batteries. And I think that this is what these plug-in hybrid vehicles do quite well. And they can probably reduce the size of the battery pack as those motors become more efficient. But again, an engineering question more than a movie maker question.
One more phone call. Steve in Fitchburg. Hi.
Hi. You said that the grid can be cleaned up. Could you speak a little bit to making a smart grid? We plug in our cars, and then our houses can run off our cars?
Yeah, great question. People say, well, what about electric cars causing blackouts? You know, we don't have unlimited electricity. Well, the surveys show that there's about 150 million cars you could run, plug in, and charge right now on the existing grid. That's 100 million cars, way more than we have.
Ooh.
And the power companies like it because for the first time, in theory, they can use cars as backup battery if we're doing a blackout or something. So you tell the car company when you park your car at work that from 3 in the afternoon till 5 in the afternoon, they can buy power from your car if they have an emergency.
Oh.
And they go, great, because this will save us from, you know, Milwaukee going down or something like this. So it's part of the smart grid and stabilizing the future of the power.
Yeah, fascinating.
Yeah, thanks, good question. Thanks
for the call. What are you working on now, sir?
I'd love to do a movie about bicycles.
Really?
Yeah, because You know, bicycles came. Bicycles are a pretty modern invention, and they're so efficient. And there's kind of all kinds of bicycle culture going on right now. But you know, the trick with these movies, Kathleen, is you got to raise money. It takes a long time to make them happen. So I'd like to see that the Revenge of the Electric Car gets seen by a lot of people, and make sure that we can share that story, and then we'll move to the next project.
Right. Always the next project, right?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Now, when will this be out on DVD?
Should be out on DVD early next year.
Okay.
So, yeah, watch for that. And hopefully I'll get out to Madison for a screening, because Wisconsin's always been such a great supporter of,
yes,
of my work and this issue, and I really appreciate the exposure.
Yeah, people in Wisconsin love this issue. They love this issue.
That's even what
jammed
with people
vocals
there.
Yeah, thanks very much for being with us, Chris.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Chris Payne, Revenge of the Electric Car, is his newly released film, and we thank him for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production here in our studios based in downtown Milwaukee. We'll be with you again Monday, and we'll do our normal all things political. We'll start off the week with that at 9 o'clock. Thanks very, very much for listening. And Rhonda reminds me, next Wednesday at 10, we will... Oh, am I going to have time to talk about the Muppets? Okay. Thanks.